Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Monday, over 600 million people were without power across India in what was reportedly the largest power collapse in their history. It impacted every aspect of daily life. Trains were stalled, emergency rooms and hospitals couldn't function, traffic lights went dead in New Delhi, and hundreds of miners were stranded in coal shafts in West Bengal. Today's guest, Rebecca Byerly, who is just back from Meghalaya, India, reports that the country relies on coal, which is neither helpful with peak power shortages nor is regulated enough. Justin Guay, a coal expert, told her that the outage exposed the failure of a coal-fired grid to address the real problem, peak power shortages. He says solar energy, improved efficiency, and natural gas are much more plausible solutions for delivering energy when India needs it at peak times, such as when millions of people flip on their air conditioners. Rebecca Byerly is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor based in India, and she's currently in New York. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
Well, it's great to have you. As we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I think the New York Times out of Delhi did an excellent job covering the power cuts across India. But, you know, I want to specifically highlight the work of Adam Nossiter from the New York Times. Mr. Nossiter spent the last 20 years in the southern region of the United States, but recently became the New York Times West Africa Bureau Chief. And on Monday, he had an article come out that was called Islamists, the North Mali Stone Couple. And it was just a horrible story of a couple that allegedly had a relationship outside of marriage and were stoned to death by the Islamists of Ansar Dine, or the Defenders of Faith. It's a group that has moved into Mali, and it's very similar to the Taliban in the way they are instilling Sharia law and defacing the cultural relics of Mali. And, you know, as journalists, when we can find the human story to really paint a picture of a much larger problem in an area, I think that that's when we can say we've succeeded. And, you know, as a journalist, I read news constantly, but his story is a story I cannot shake because he just wrote it so well and really brought it home for readers, or at least for me. So I definitely want to highlight Mr. Nossiter's work. And it's not a happy story, but it's a story that needs to be told. And it's an issue that's developing in Mali that we need to pay closer attention to.
I haven't been following this at all. Why was this couple stoned?
Well, they were stoned because they allegedly, and this is completely alleged, had a relationship outside of marriage and had a 6.5-month-old child, which they said was not theirs. And so this Islamic extremist group called Islamist of Ansar Dine, or Defenders of the Faith, came into Mali in April or March and basically overtaken the country. And they are instilling Sharia law. And, of course, according to Sharia law, that's unacceptable. So there was no trial. They found this couple, took them 12 miles from the village they were in, dug two holes that were 4 feet deep, and proceeded to kill them. And this is the story of one couple, you know, one couple that this reporter was able to highlight. But there's unfortunately probably going to be many more stories like this. It's very similar to what we saw happen in Afghanistan.
And so what's next for Mali? Did he go into that? Did he talk to people about what's to come?
Well, there was a follow-up in the New York Times on August 1st called The End of Timbuktu, which Timbuktu has been a vibrant city in Mali for centuries. And now it's a ghost town. Reporters can't go in. The Sufi shrine from the 15th century was defaced, similar to what happened in Bamiyan in Afghanistan. This happened a couple weeks back. So, I mean, it's really not looking good. I am not an expert on this area, so I don't want to say. But it looks like things like what happened to this couple could happen more in the future. And there's already been, for example, women are being forced to cover, liquor stores have closed. If a couple that's not married is seen on the street together, they're forced to marry on the spot. And that is the reality for the people, the growing reality for the people in Mali.
I was just looking up a couple of articles, and it says that hundreds of thousands of people are in refugee camps.
That's right.
So they're fleeing.
Right.
You know, I'm so glad you brought this up, because when we talk about doing our Friday shows, we always say that we need to do more stories about, Africa, and do it in such a way that's not just sort of, here's what's happening in Africa, like so many in the media do. Like CNN, for example, will have their Africa special. But we don't do a good enough job of it. Do you know, for example, are there many New York Times reporters in different African countries?
Well, I know that Mr. Nasseter covers West Africa.
Okay.
And the New York Times generally does. I mean, in Delhi, they have three main reporters and then several, assistants that work for them. So, usually the New York Times does a thorough job of having reporters on the ground. But since that's not the area I cover, I'm not sure.
What about the Christian Science Monitor in Africa?
The Christian Science Monitor, again, I'm not as familiar with what they cover in Africa. The reporters they have, I mean, the Monitor, again, has reporters across the globe.
Right.
And these, you have to know, like, too, as a journalist, these stories are really hard to cover. I mean, Mr. Nasseter was not able to go into this village. There are no journalists in Timbuktu because the likelihood of being killed right now is quite high. Mm. So this story came from a report he got from a phone call with a person who was on the ground in this village. I mean, the villagers were forced to watch this execution. And, of course, after this, many of them said, this is not Islam. This is terrible. They were killed like animals and were leaving. So, even Mr. Nasseter could not go into this particular area and witness this. This came from a phone call of a brave individual who, even though he was not, his name was not quoted, essentially risked his life to tell this story.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this up, and we'll be following this, and we'll put a link to this piece right after the show. We're talking with Rebecca Byerly. She is a correspondent, she's a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, based in India. She's joining us from New York, and she's just back from India, where she's been covering the largest power outage. Is this in the world's history? Is that right?
World's history.
Wow.
Actually, if you look at the statistics, it's by far the largest power, outage in the world's history.
So give us an overview. What happened on Monday?
Well, a personal note, I got a phone call on Sunday night from a flatmate and said, the power's gone, it hasn't come back on, and having lived in India for 4 years, it's sort of like, we'll get over it, because that's just life in Delhi. That's just what a normal part of life is, that you may or may not have power. And by Monday, when the power wasn't back on, and it had been off for about 12 hours at that point, and of course headlines were coming through that this wasn't just, an isolated event in Delhi, that this was across the northern region of the country, I realized this was abnormal, even though not having power is a normal part of life. So, basically what happened is that either there was a glitch in the grid, or the states drew too much power. There's three power grids in India that went out, and it put 10% of the world's population, or over half the population in India, which is over 600 million people, without power.
And where are they today? Is the power back for most of them?
The power is back. Now the blame game of who's responsible has started.
Right.
In fact, the former power minister, Mr. Shinde, has said, that people should focus on how fast the power was restored rather than, the fact that they lost power. But what I saw, what I've understood in India is, the new coal power minister, Mr. Malia, said, this is never going to happen again. Which is a big statement concerning the infrastructure problems that are, just such a problem in India.
Well, and what are your thoughts on the coverage? Because, for example, the New York Times has a piece about this, and they quoted Ramachandra Guha. He's an Indian historian. He says that the blackout was only the latest evidence of government dysfunction. He says, quote, India needs to stop strutting on the world stage like it's a great power and focus on its deep problems within. This is interesting because we keep equating India as an emerging power on the world stage, and we don't really hear about these infrastructure problems.
Yeah, let's like to put this into perspective. 50% of the villages in rural India do not have power. That's 400 million people in India that don't have power, don't have access to electricity daily. That, I believe, is, you know, larger than the population of the U.S. And that is a daily part of life. We talk about coal, which is certainly an issue. I mean, coal is not the solution to India's power problems. And one thing that may come up is that there was not enough coal for these coal plants in India. And because of that, there should be a lift on the ban, an environmental ban, which is preventing, you know, the more coal mines, that should be lifted so there should be more access to coal. But if you look at the problem is infrastructure. How can you get coal across the country when you don't have roads? I mean, something as basic as roads. And then, of course, there's corruption. I mean, one of the things that could have happened here is states, the heads of state of different Indian states, you know, they have to cut power because there's simply not enough power to supply to India and this expanding India that we're seeing. But when you're trying to win an election, it's difficult to cut power to tell your constituent or a potential constituent, you know, we or supporter, you need to cut power.
Right.
And that delves back into the corruption problem that is so rampant across India.
Well, and it's interesting, just to let listeners know, if you're out in the village in India, for example, the electricity goes off without any notice, and the villagers say, oh, well, they needed more of it in Delhi or Mumbai, for example. It's just an everyday fact. And I was there at, it was 2003, and meeting with villagers working in different factories, and they said, yeah, and what happens when the power goes out is we have to stop working, but we have to make up for the time. So if it's out for 3 hours, we have to work an additional 3 hours and just wait until it comes back on.
Right. I mean, you know, you can't function. Like, a country can't, it's very difficult to function. I mean, it does function. I mean, I can say that I don't have power all the time, and I, 3 years ago, decided, you know, I can't deal with this. Summer's coming up. It's going to be so hot. I'm going to live in a place that has a generator. Really, the power backup for India is diesel-run generators, which are hugely polluting, very expensive, very loud. And I realized that I could not afford to live in an apartment in Delhi that has power, like that has a power backup. So it's on the village level, it's on the middle class. I mean, in some ways, the very poor in India were less affected by this than the middle class because they've come up with alternative forms of energy like solar. They've been able to adapt, and they don't rely on the grid because the grid doesn't reach them. I live, you know, at the upper middle class, upper middle class lifestyle in India, and even then I don't have power 24/7 in a day.
Well, how much would it be to live in Delhi with the kind of situation you're describing?
Well, this is shocking, but you would pay several thousand dollars a month.
Wow.
To have a mediocre flat with a real generator that will keep the power on 24/7. And you know, the bigger picture of why this is important, I mean, one correspondent without power does not matter. But when you're trying to expand this country and you're trying to get foreign investors to come in, you know, federal direct investment in retail is a constant theme in India. But this, when you have nearly 700 million people without power, that is alarming. That could be very alarming for international investors.
We're speaking with Rebecca Byerly. She's a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor based in India. And her latest piece is Why Coal Has Not Been a Savior. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Rebecca has lived in India for 4 years. So if you have any questions for her about her reporting the status of local media in India. We'd love to hear from you. And what did you make of coverage about this power blackout? It does raise a lot of questions about India's infrastructure. It is often looked at as a sort of emerging powerhouse. And this brings up a lot of issues about what that means, the gap between the rich and the poor, corruption, for example. So did any of that come out in the reporting that you saw this week? And what questions do you think reporters should be asking on this story? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. So let's talk a little bit about your story, because you filed your piece from, is it Meghalaya?
Meghalaya.
Meghalaya.
The northeastern part of India next to the border of Bangladesh.
And so this is a coal mining region?
It is a coal mining region. I was in the Jhantia Hills, and the Jhantia Hills and the Garo Hills of Meghalaya are both coal mining regions. It's unique to other parts of India because it has a special status. The northeastern part of India was a tribal area, so there's a special status that gives it the laws that apply in the rest of India don't apply in Meghalaya. So you've got tens of thousands of unregulated coal mines across the state that are called rat hole mines. I mean, they're very, very small, and people use the most rudimentary tools, flashlight, duct tape to their heads, going down ladders that are 100 feet long, these rickety ladders and flip-flops to extract coal.
And you report that in July, 15 miners were killed and a dozen more narrowly escaped when a tunnel they were mining in another area of the state flooded. And then in this particular area, you describe it as something out of an apocalyptic movie. Mountains of tar-black coal, polluted orange rivers, and seemingly bottomless holes plunge more than 100 feet beneath the Earth's surface.
And the reason that's so important is this apocalyptic picture that I painted is created by man. It's created by the coal barons, the people who have the coal mines, are now the politicians in Meghalaya, in the state, and also in the nation. Vincent Paul is the Union Minister of Water Resources, which means he overlooks water for all of India, and his family is one of the biggest coal mining families in Meghalaya. And what that means, I mean, is that it's very difficult to get any kind of mining regulation in the state. Mining regulations that would improve the environment or protect the environment, the river that runs through the Jhantia Hills is either like a bright, bright blue or this really orange, sludgy orange color. Mm. The fish die. You can't grow agriculture because the ground is so acidic. And it's very difficult to do anything about this. And then also you have a lot of child labor. Mm. And there's virtually no labor laws to protect children, to protect minors. I wrote about Gulam, who was this woman I met, I mean, in this little thatched roof in the middle of mountains of coal. And it was blazing hot. She had two small daughters and two younger brothers. And there was a coal mine that I went down it for about 80 feet, and I had had enough. So I don't know how far it went down, but it was well over 100 feet. That was literally right next to her house. Mm. And she just knows that there is no protection here. I mean, this is how she makes money. Her father died in the mine. Her husband and her sons now work in the mine, and it's a part of their life. She told me so casually that, yeah, you know, everyone knows you can't drink the water. It'll burn your skin, and your hair will fall out. So I think, you know, coal mining's been a global problem in West Virginia, in the U.S. I mean, it's a global problem. But when you talk to the people on the ground and you see how it impacts their life and how it impacts the environment, and it takes a very long time for the environment to heal from these things, and then you understand that the people who are making the policies are also directly tied to the coal mines.
There's a human behind the flashy signs in the big towns. And as you report, there's about 70,000 children under the age of 16 working in these mines. And local NGOs reveal that most of these children are trafficked from Bangladesh and Nepal and kept as laborers until they can pay for their freedom. Can you talk more about that?
Well, that was actually, I didn't quote the statistic of 70,000, but that was a report done by Impulse, which is a non-governmental organization out of Meghalaya that is run by this woman called Hasina Karbia. And she had done an in-depth report and found that, you know, there was a lot of kids being trafficked from Nepal, from Bangladesh, being told, you know, they had this promise of work, and then they would be taken to these mines and be indigent, would essentially become indentured servants. And there's nothing around this area. I mean, would be no opportunity, very little opportunity to get an education. There's very little access to a hospital if something were to happen. So it would be difficult, you know, if you're taking to this mine in the middle of nowhere in this far-flung part of India, and you may or may not speak the language, it would be very difficult to get out of that situation.
We're speaking with Rebecca Byerly, Christian Science Monitor correspondent who's based in India, and we're talking with her from New York. You can find her piece, India's Big Power Blackout, Why Coal Hasn't Been a Savior, at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Hi. Hello, Rebecca.
Hey, George.
We're thinking of India, and perhaps we're not alone in thinking that India's rivers are an inexhaustible source of water, but we also know now that the glaciers and the snowmass in the Himalayas that feed those rivers are diminishing, and perhaps they're diminishing to the extent that we can't think of them any longer as inexhaustible rivers. To what extent is this an issue? And I bring this up because, of course, without water from those rivers, not only is agriculture not feasible, but the production of power from burning coal isn't feasible. To what extent is that an issue in India?
Oh, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a huge issue in India. Water, and it, you know, you have to see like how the rivers run in India. The river, like from Kashmir, where the Himalayas are, runs into Pakistan. And in the northeastern part of India, it runs into Bangladesh and onto the Bay of Bengal. So on both sides of the country, water supply is critical. Just to point out an interesting fact, in the northeastern part of India, which is where Meghalaya is, it is the wettest place on Earth. Hmm. They've had the most reported rainfall of any place on the planet. And they're having these water problems. They're having a shortage of water. Which is hard to imagine, that it's not raining, it's that these mining, you know, it's not just mining too. There's been coal. I mean, there's in addition to coal, there's cement plants. I mean, it's not just coal mining. But you can see on both sides of the country, you often hear about the Himalayas and the shortage of water there and how that will affect Pakistan and the rivers flowing all the way to Rajasthan, where water's already a huge issue. But then on the northeastern part of the country, which I think less journalists travel to, you have the wettest place on Earth, and you're also running into these serious water problems. And the water, some of the water from these rivers runs on into Bangladesh.
Well, thank you for the call. We're going to take a quick break, and you can join us at 866-798-8255. When we come back, Rebecca will tell us how she found out about this story, and we'll ask her what she's working on now and where this goes from here. 866-798-8255. And after the break, we'll also be joined by David K. Johnston. We'll talk to him about coverage, or the lack of coverage, of free trade agreements. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. And you can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. On Monday, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about fun things to do this summer. We'll talk about museums, nature walks, hikes, free events, and we'd love to hear from you. Where do you go to find free activities? We're also putting shows together next week about communication within the environmental movement. How can they get their message across? How have they done so far, and how can they do it better? And then we'll also talk about what we can learn from single-payer healthcare in Vermont. That's next week. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we're speaking with Rebecca Byerly, Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in India, about the largest power outage in the world's history. And before we let you go, Rebecca, I just wanted to know, your piece is so good, and you did such a good job of taking an event and not doing sort of formulaic reporting. You actually took it and went deeper. How did you find out about this mine?
Well, I became friends with a person who's from Meghalaya several years ago. And, you know, he works for the UN and had told me, Brinley Lindu is his name, had told me many times through the years, you know, that you've got to see what's happening in Meghalaya. Mm. And, you know, I really believe that a huge part of my job as a journalist is to get out, to travel, to sit with the people, to get outside of Delhi. And I really strive to do that. And Meghalaya is certainly an underreported part of India. So this particular person had mentioned this problem several years ago, and at that time it was uranium mining, which in some ways is even worse than coal mining. So I have been following this for some time, and then took most of the month of March to go to Meghalaya and to see these things for myself. And something to note with Meghalaya is that it was a tribal place before the British came, and they were animists before they became, a lot of them became Christians because of the British. But that meant that they worshiped the trees, that they worshiped the forest. Mm. So there's been widespread deforestation across Meghalaya, and a lot of that is because of coal mining. These are people who have sacred forests where they go, and it's like a sanctuary for trees. It's like their god. So it just kind of puts things into perspective of how sacred the environment was and how that's unfortunately changed.
It's just such an incredible story. What are you working on right now?
Well, and this next story, it really relates back to Meghalaya. And what before I talk about the next story, I just want to say that why the story of Meghalaya is important is it's a microcosm for the rest of what's happening in the rest of India, that coal really isn't the answer. And infrastructure needs to improve. Corruption is a huge problem across the country. And if you look in Meghalaya, it's just really easy to identify it. It's easy to see, okay, well, you know, you have coal barons who are politicians, and it's going to be difficult to get a mining policy that's going to benefit the environment and also have labor regulations for the people.
Mm. Yeah, you could.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say, you could say this is happening around the globe.
Oh, you could. Absolutely. You absolutely could. And I never want to overlook what happens in the country I come from, which is the United States. And never would, you know, look at India and say it doesn't happen in the U.S. because it absolutely does.
Right.
But when we get to the crux of what happened with this massive blackout we've seen this week in India, a lot of it's going to come down to corruption. So the next story that I would like to cover is this movement by Anna Hazare, who has been this campaigner against corruption. He just ended a fast in India yesterday, and he's now looking for an alternative, a political alternative to lead in India in the 2014 elections. And I'll be really interested to see where that story goes and how is India really going to fight corruption.
Well, thank you so much for your reporting, and we will definitely have you back.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with people in the field.
Well, thank you. That is
just a note, you can find my work at readrebecca.com.
Okay, great. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
That's Rebecca Byerly. She's a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor based in India. And you can also find her excellent reporting at yourcallradio.org. And it's our weekly media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And we're going to switch gears now and speak with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter and columnist at Reuters, about his latest columns focusing on taxes and the free trade deals, which surprisingly haven't gotten much attention at all. David is author of the best-selling book Free Lunch and his new book The Fine Print: How Big Companies Use Plain English and Other Tricks to Rob You Blind will be out next month. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I know you just got off the plane, so thank you for joining us. And I want to ask you, David, about your latest column about the free trade deal in South Korea. Before we get to the specifics, Public Citizen has been sending out so many news releases over the last couple of months talking about these free trade deals, offshoring millions of jobs, freeing bankers from oversight. Why aren't these free trade deals getting more attention?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, we've radically cut the number of journalists in this country. There was a report out earlier this year that the fastest disappearing job in America was journalist. Something like 28% of journalism newsroom jobs have disappeared in the last, I think it's 5 years. Secondly, a lot of the news you get from Washington and from financial organizations is based on the press releases put out not by people like Public Citizen, but by the White House, top Senate leaders, and big business companies. And so a lot of the news that you get is simply taking the official version of events as put out in the press release and regurgitating it, mixing it with some other material, and creating news out of it. Very little news is where the reporter on his or her own says, this is what we ought to be doing, what I call enterprise reporting.
Yeah, I've been kind of shocked by the simplistic presidential coverage. I'd love to get your take on it. It's mostly he said, and it's very rare for the reporter to actually let us know what is fact.
Absolutely. But, you know, the horse race problem and the stump speech problem coverage have been with us for forever. I mean, that's how Teddy White, in his 1960 book, broke through on the campaign trail, and then even more so the actress Lindsay Krause's brother, Timothy Krause, in the 72 campaign. He wrote The Boys on the Bus about what it was like. And one of the things people I don't think realize is the candidate less and less talked to reporters. Now, in the 2000 campaign, George W. Bush talked a lot with reporters and joked with them and knew certain things about them. Al Gore rarely spoke to them and was stiff as a board when he did and treated them like unwelcome guests. Mitt Romney does not talk to reporters. Mm-hmm. He only does controlled, very controlled events. And not apparently in his case without reason, given his tendency to go off message or not or say things that confuse what he's trying to do. Obama does talk to reporters a lot. And, you know, politicians who talk to the reporters covering them tend to get better coverage than those who don't. Surprise, surprise.
Right. And, of course, this week it was all about the gaffes on the campaign trail with Romney. It was just endless stories about these gaffes.
Right.
But let's...
In this case, they're kind of serious. I mean, after all, if you're going to be president of the United States, where there is no test for it except a campaign, you go to London and proceed to gratuitously insult the British, who were all over him. I mean, left, right, didn't matter. They were all, you're insulting us.
And do you think this is worth covering, David? Because when we think about what we want to do on Fridays, we often have conflicting views about it. Should we follow this or should we try to find, you know, a column like yours that no one else is talking about? I mean, I prefer to have you on to talk about the column no one's talking about. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, thank you, Rose. I mean, I think, look, we need to cover everything. You know, you need to have people in the newspaper who can cover sports and funny and fights at City Hall. And I think it's important to cover the candidates very, very intensely because it's the only shot we get at understanding who they are. I mean, imagine if, for example, there hadn't been the rather simple questions asked of Sarah Palin
right,
that quickly revealed to the whole world that she didn't know anything. And if you haven't seen the HBO movie about it, I strongly recommend it to people listening. It is a number of the people in the movie say it's spot on, and it is really troubling that someone even considered Sarah Palin for any public office, but to be a heartbeat away from your finger on the button is a terrifying thought.
And is that the game changer? Or
yes, game changer.
Game change. Okay, right. And I understand that's on my list, but I understand just 5 weeks into the campaign, the McCain camp knew that they made a mistake.
Yeah, it's surprising that it took them that long based on what they subsequently learned. But, you know, there's a reason that campaigns have vetting processes and they check people out and they vetted her in a hurry. And you know, it's kind of interesting. Mitt Romney, whether you despise him or like him, Mitt Romney is qualified to be president of the United States. He is a competent manager. Sarah Palin, I'm sorry, not competent to be mayor of the town she ran, which she put deeply into debt and mysteriously somehow ended up with a large home and no mortgage that can't be explained by the public disclosures of her and her husband's income.
We're speaking with David K. Johnston, a columnist at Reuters and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. You can find his latest columns at yourcallradio.org. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What do you make of political coverage? Where are you going for substance? And we'll talk with David in just a couple minutes about coverage of taxes. But first, David, let's talk about your column about the South Korea trade deal. So you were there. We're talking about... Where were you exactly in South Korea?
I went to Seoul. Okay. I go to China every year to teach investigative reporting under the auspices of the University of Missouri, sometimes twice a year.
Okay.
And then I go somewhere. And in this case, I went to Seoul in early July, and Reuters flew in a very good videographer. The locals told us we couldn't do what we weren't going to do, but in 2 days, we got all these car dealers to let us in their showrooms unannounced, and we shot footage, and we went hunting on the streets of Seoul for American cars. Every 11th car sold in America is a Kia or a Hyundai, which are owned by the same company. Many of them are assembled at factories in Georgia, factories that were bought and paid for primarily by the taxpayers and made gifts, as is the common practice now for factories all across America. It isn't the capitalists putting up the money, it's the taxpayers. And in South Korea, under this free trade agreement, the question was, are there going to be American jobs selling American cars there? And the video I have, which I'm very proud of, it's embedded in my column, has a fun look at trying to find American cars on the streets of Korea. And we have government officials and other people about what will happen. But these free trade deals, all 19 of them, have all been bad deals for America. And the China deal, which is technically not a free trade deal, has been unbelievably awful. The official government estimate was that we would run a $1 billion a year trade deficit with China. Last year, we ran a deficit of almost $300 billion. Before NAFTA, we had a trade surplus with Mexico of about $2.6 billion in today's dollars. We now run a $64 billion trade deficit. All of these free trade deals and the China liberalized trade deal have been really, really bad. They've cost us at least 5.5 million jobs so far.
Wow. Well, and
that's essentially every job, by the way, in Michigan, Iowa, and metropolitan Valdosta, Georgia.
Well, and you report that more than 9 out of 10 cars sold here are made in South Korea.
No.
Sold in Seoul.
Nine out of cars sold in South Korea.
In South Korea are made,
made in South Korea.
Right.
And the principal foreign cars that are sold there are Mercedes, BMW, Audi, Bentley. The best-selling American car in a country of 50 million people is the Ford Explorer SUV, and they sell about 100 a month. That's less than 0.1% of monthly car sales in South Korea.
Wow. So what do the facts tell us? President Obama says that this deal will create 70,000 American jobs.
Well, it will create some jobs in other areas. The Koreans have now opened up, at least ostensibly opened up, their legal, accounting, architectural, engineering, and other professional services market. So this may lead to some American jobs. But American cars for the next 4 years sold in Korea still come with a tariff. And the Ford Motor Company 2 years ago took out a big full-page ad in several newspapers complaining that every single person who bought a Ford car in Korea was subjected to an intense tax audit by the South Korean government. The government's promised they're not going to do that anymore. But when I was there, I asked Koreans about this. I would say, well, what about buying an American car? And they would say, oh, no, tax audit. No, don't buy American. So the idea that has been ingrained in the culture that if you buy an American car, you'll get a tax audit. But I don't see any way that this will end up creating jobs. The Economic Policy Institute, whose study I link to in my column, mm-hmm. thinks there'll be $159,000 jobs lost net. And I certainly think that they're in the right ballpark based on my reading of the official government data and the past experience of these deals.
So going back to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, according to Public Citizen, it would decrease access to medicine, flood the U.S. with unsafe food and products, and empower corporations to attack environmental and health safeguards.
Right.
Are you seeing these
incredibly secretive deals, Rose, that nobody knows about?
Right.
They're negotiated pretty much in private. Some of it's disclosed. And you, if you're involved in one of these deals, you get to sue in your home country. And you can overturn a U.S. federal law, a U.S. state law, a city council ruling that you say interferes with your business. It's an incredible attack on sovereignty. And this is part of the reason that for years I have been saying the problem is not free trade. There's no such thing as free trade. But the problem isn't expanding world trade. It's that the rules are being written by the financier class for the financier class at the expense of everybody else. And if you're a financier on a global basis, you can exploit both sides of this deal. You move the factories and the jobs to a place like China or Korea, where you can have control of the workforce and pay a lot less money. And you sell the goods and you sell financing to people in a place like the United States, where Congress allows you to earn tax-free or taxed in the far distant future profits.
And according...
You win on both sides.
Well, and according to Public Citizen, we're talking about closed-door talks between the U.S., Australia, Chile, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, Malaysia, and Vietnam. Japan and China will potentially join later. They say that 600 corporate advisors have access to these documents and the text, while the public, members of Congress, and journalists are excluded.
Right. That's exactly correct. There's some documents that come out, and that's why Lori Wallach, who's probably wrote the piece you're talking about, is able to go through this. It's incredibly technical. It's very wrapped in secrecy. And here's the great historical point. I teach in the Graduate Business School and the Law School at Syracuse University. I teach the law of the ancient world. Corporations began under the Romans in service to the state. The idea of a corporation was to create this entity to serve the state, whether it was to take care of the property of someone who was appointed a general to go suppress the Palestinians or the Gauls or some other reason. Today, what you're seeing, and this Trans-Pacific Agreement demonstrates it, is that the state has now been subordinated to the multinational corporation, and the state exists to serve the corporation. And my new book, The Fine Print, is about how these mechanisms, many of which have never been written about by anybody or just by me in my column, are a privatized system to transfer wealth and income up, to take away your rights, to shut down government access to what government is doing, and to essentially rig the game on behalf of this narrow multinational financier class who are unbelievably fabulously wealthy.
And that upcoming book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain Language and Other Tricks to Rob You Blind. It'll be out next month, and we will definitely have David back to talk about that. You're probably familiar with his best-selling book, Free Lunch. You can find more information about his work at yourcallradio.org. And we have about 6 or so minutes left if you'd like to join us. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you think about coverage of these issues, and have you seen much coverage of these free trade deals? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have a listener comment from Leslie in Berkeley. She says, can you suggest another phrase to describe trade deals like NAFTA and CAFTA, which disadvantage underdeveloped countries? Every time critics of these trade policies use free in free trade, we're giving a gift to those few already wealthy people who benefit from the policies and misleading many Americans about the goals of those policies.
Well, that's a good question. I have not thought up, Leslie, a nice little marketing slogan, a headline for it. But in the video, if you watch it, you'll see me say that what these deals are is America gets the short end of the stick. It's true in all of these deals. They've been very bad for the United States. And what I don't understand is why we don't have policy based on empirical evidence. We have policy based on ideology, you know, the Chicago School, of which I'm an apostate, but not actual evidence. And the actual evidence is these quote-unquote free trade deals. They're not free trade deals. They're rigged markets to benefit certain groups.
So why is this happening, David? Because you've got people from all walks of political life opposing these free trade deals. What explains the fact that the Bush deals are continuing under Obama?
Well, because the dominant forces working in Washington are the highly paid, highly polished representatives of big corporations and groups of corporations, and in a few cases, wealthy individuals, who every day are up on Capitol Hill, you know, feeding information to members of Congress and making it clear that if you don't play ball to some degree, you will not get reelected. I mean, they can shut money off. The record isn't perfect. I mean, it's the world is a messy place. It isn't black and white. But the clear trend is, you know, play ball the way we see it, define the world we see it, or we will get rid of you. And so long as so many millions of Americans are busy, you know, paying attention to the Kardashian sisters' romances du jour and to Dancing with the Stars instead of politics, I don't see this changing. The real core problem is the campaign finance system. And this abominable decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that no true originalist Supreme Court justice could ever have supported. Because when this country was founded, corporations were treated as suspect. They were only allowed to exist for a single purpose. They could only exist for 20 years. They had to prove that their existence provided a social benefit, and hiring people wasn't counted. That's what you had to do to run the business. And so what we're seeing is our democracy being supplanted by corporate interests. And that's not to be against corporations. They're perfectly good things, but we don't have the right rules to control corporations and use them, and we are eventually going to have them controlling us. And there's a lot about how to think about that in the fine print.
We have a question from Celine in Capitola. She says, isn't there a movement in Congress to slow down these trade deals so Congress people can get access to them before they're ratified? Even if they need to be ratified, is there any way to support the push for disclosure?
Yes, there are members of Congress, including some people who are Tea Party types, who are raising questions about these deals. And I think that if people hear a lot more, members of Congress hear a lot more, the public doesn't like secret deals, we don't need to have secret deals, that may help slow these things down. But the culture overall is what has to be gone at here. This culture and this belief in the Chicago School ideology is a dogma that's not to be questioned. And so, yes, write to your member of Congress. Don't send them a long screed. Write them a short, pointed note. Get friends to do that. When members of Congress show up in your district, Capitola, where I used to live when I was a teenager, show up at events with a bunch of friends and pepper the room and ask coordinated questions to make it clear that the congressperson is being watched, and have other people go to other ones. And if people start doing that kind of guerrilla action, I think that it will have an effect on Congress.
Well, and also, in order to get more people to do this, these issues need media coverage so people know what's going on.
Yeah, it's real hard to get decent media coverage, though. I mean, you know, newspapers do not pay particularly good salaries. They pay above average salaries. But actually, there's a new study out. The average journalist in America makes $33,000 a year, which is the average wage for full-time workers.
Mm.
Most of the deeply experienced reporters have been pushed out. I'm kind of an anomaly as a graybeard. And the younger generation of journalists are rich with people who believe that you are supposed to explain what authority has to say, not to cross-examine, question, challenge, and independently assess what authority says.
Do you talk to any of your colleagues about these free trade agreements? Do you ever say, you know, why don't you spend more time covering them?
Not that particular issue very much, because there are so few reporters that do it. I mean, I'm the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, which is 4,200 of us who are trying to make sure that we pass on to future generations the skills that we have, so because newsrooms are not doing that anymore. And certainly among members of the board at IRE and the longtime members, there's a lot of discussion we have about how do we do these things? How do we get them to happen? I was recently trying to help a very competent, skeptical, and incredibly computer and statistical savvy reporter get hired at a business newspaper. And she was pointing out to them all these skills she has and things she could do that business readers would want. And instead, they hired somebody who can write soft, nice, glowing features about wonderful business leaders in the community.
Well, David, we've got about a minute left. Unfortunately, we didn't get to talk about taxes. Just quickly, what are your thoughts on all of the coverage that Romney's tax plan got this week?
I've been calling on Romney to release all of his returns since 1984. I don't think that President Obama would have said in that ad, where there's some years you didn't pay taxes without knowing it. Romney's taxes have been out. He gave 23 years of them to the McCain campaign. So there are things floating around, and I suspect Romney is vastly wealthier than his claim of no more than $250 million, based on some of the things that we have seen.
And the Tax Policy Center released a report that found his tax plan would raise taxes on middle and lower income earners while lowering the overall tax burden on the wealthiest.
Right. He would go after families with children under 17 and poor people or middle class people who want to go to college, which the second of which strikes me as an absolutely ridiculous policy proposal. But I can't get to him to ask questions about it. I will point out one little thing. A junior partner who worked under him has publicly said what his wealth is, and it's twice that of Romney. So it's kind of hard to believe that Romney had a guy who was a junior partner of him in the Bain deals who's worth twice as much as Romney says he's worth.
Hmm. Well, David K. Johnston will be following this, and we look forward to having you on to talk about your new book, The Fine Print. Thanks so much, David. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What are you doing for fun this summer that's free or low cost? On the next Jour Call, we'll have a conversation about free events, museums, nature walks, and hikes. What about free and low-cost staycations, where you take off a couple days and enjoy your area? What are your recommendations? We'll be joined by sfkids.org, FunCheapSF, and the Nature Institute. Where do you go to find free activities? It's Jour Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Comedian Michael Ian Black has a new memoir. Up till now, his comedy might have been described as, I don't know, smarmy, but the book's different.
I have a knack for saying awful things, and part of the reason that I wrote this book was to start dismantling that persona.
Michael Ian Black on Bullseye from PRI.
Bullseye, Sunday at 4 here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. This is a test of the emergency broadcasting system. This concludes this test of the emergency broadcasting system. This is KALW San Francisco.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Shaima Khalil. As part of our program today, we take your questions on the situation in Syria.
We've confirmed that Mr. Annan's job was impossible. We must recognize it, and for him to decide to resign is not surprising. What is very serious, though, is the feeling that maybe we never had a political process.
UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan has resigned after the failure of his six-point peace plan. The Syrian army has been shelling rebel positions in Aleppo, and there's been bloodshed in Hama and Damascus. As the conflict deepens in Syria's two main cities, diplomacy seems to be going nowhere. So what lies ahead for Syria? Has the political process failed? The BBC's Jim Muir will be live on World Have Your Say to answer your questions. You can call us on country code 44203.